Molly Tibbetts was many things. At her funeral, her family called her a giggler, a reader, an actress, and an advocate. She was also a runner who never came home. Today, what Tibbetts' murder teaches us about our culture and women's safety. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In the wake of Molly Tibbetts' murder, many women are questioning themselves as they lace up their running shoes. But a lot of people are also asking important questions about what it means about our culture if women don't feel safe in their communities. This hour, I'll talk with Des Moines Register columnist Rekha Basu, violence prevention specialists Annette Lynch and Cody Howell, and trail runner Kelly Tiesling. We also want to hear from you. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Last month, 20-year-old Molly Tibbetts of Brookland, Iowa, went out for a run and never came home. Her disappearance launched a massive search effort, and now we know that she was murdered. There's a suspect in custody, a 24-year-old man who allegedly followed her on her run, and when his sexual advances were rejected, murdered her. We may never know the whole story of what happened that evening, but this heartbreaking event has started many conversations about what a crime like this can tell us about our culture. In this hour, I'll talk with violence prevention specialists and a dedicated woman runner. My first guest today is Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register, who published a column last week titled, "Instead of Blaming Immigration for Molly Tibbetts' Death, Blame Misogyny." Rekha, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Charity.
You have written a great deal about violence against women over your long career. What was your reaction when you learned what happened to Molly Tibbetts?
First of all, I was horrified, and I also knew that as soon as word came out that he was possibly in this country illegally, it was going to kick up a huge reaction on the part of the right and people who wanted to use that fact for political gain. And, I mean, I think the issue, to me, the issue is so clear-cut. It's one about violence against women. It's one about misogyny. It's one about the sense of, you know, in general, in our culture and in our society, of male entitlement. And as you said, his sexual advances were rejected. Apparently, this is what triggered her death. What that has to do with the man's undocumented status is beyond me. And yet, everybody is making an issue of that fact. And, in fact, Charity, you know, when one writes about this or points it out, and not just my column, but several other people who posted on Facebook, one of them, a cousin of Molly Tibbetts, got some really just, she didn't get the vitriolic reaction, but another woman, an Iowa City woman in Chicago who talked about male entitlement, got vitriolic reactions to the point where, you know, she was getting death threats and people were saying that her daughter should die. Why are we so unwilling to call it for what it is?
Well, and there are a lot of people who have been watching this case so closely and, of course, searching for Molly, hoping for Molly's return for so long. People have really gotten caught up in the emotion of this tragedy. And as the facts were reported, I mean, the immigration status of the man who is suspected of committing this murder became a big part of the story. But I want to focus on what you feel the statistics that you have about violence against women and crimes committed in this country, why you feel that that's not where we need to focus.
I think that is where we need to focus.
Or no, not focus on immigration, but to focus on
Exactly. Right. Okay, so let me just give you some statistics here. Every 98 seconds, someone is sexually assaulted, and 98.9% of rapes are committed by men. 89.5% of murders are committed by men. And these are FBI statistics. 80% of violence against families and children is committed by men. 85% of intimate partner violence is committed by men. And the numbers go on and on. And if you look at the documentation on undocumented immigrants or immigrants in general committing crimes, it shows that actually they commit crimes lower than their rate in the population. So less crimes than the native-born population does per capita.
So what do you think we can take away from that, this situation, and the many other situations that you have covered over the years of women being hurt or murdered by men who have had their sexual advances rejected or in some situation of domestic conflict? What do we need to be thinking about?
I think we really need to be thinking about reforming our culture and reforming the notions of manhood and what it means to be a man in our society. And the idea that one should be able to dominate and one should be able to have access to a woman when one chooses. I've written in the past year, I've written pieces about a grandfather who molested his granddaughter and actually went to prison for it. And she was such a courageous young woman for coming forward and actually going through the trial. And then I've written about a doctor in Harlan, Iowa, who for decades was molesting these young girls who were his patients. And in both of those cases and many other cases I've written about, there was this conspiracy of silence around these perpetrators because even their female employees wanted to make excuses for them. And often it was because, you know, they had stereotypes about the people who were their victims, that they were either working class or, you know, from the wrong barn on the wrong side of the tracks or whatever. But there's this sense of protect your own, which is why something like 99% of perpetrators actually escape charges. And in the case of the doctor, he certainly did.
I'm talking with Rekha Basu. She's a columnist for the Des Moines Register. Her column published last week, Instead of Blaming Immigration for Molly Tibbetts' Death, Blame Misogyny. And we're talking this hour about what Molly Tibbetts' murder tells us about our culture and also what we need to do to change this situation. Joining us now is Cody Howell, violence prevention specialist at the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa. Hello, Cody.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Welcome back to the show. And Cody, of course, Molly Tibbetts was a University of Iowa student. So again, I mean, this is a story that hits very close to home for so many people in Iowa, so many people at the University of Iowa. What was your reaction when you learned?
I mean, of course, having this all happen there is it hits close to home. It does. And I think about the students who, you know, want answers and they want a quick answer too. A lot of people are like, what can we do? What happens now? And I think that the real answer is there's no quick fix to this. It is culture change. And so, you know, besides being sad and angry and, you know, upset, it's like, what happens now? What do we do? How can we be there for the students who are, you know, mourning and in grief, and how do we help them find answers to the questions that they have about, you know, what does it mean to be safe? What does it mean to look out for one another? What does it mean to create and cultivate a culture on campus and in the Iowa City community that looks out for one another, calls out problematic behavior, and really, you know, cares for one another? So it's a matter of saying, you know, while we're grieving, we have to always look forward and say, what can we do to make sure that, you know, we're looking out for one another? That was in my mind as, you know, as I was processing, and I noticed students coming in and feeling scared and feeling upset. And many of them knew her. Many of them were, you know, saying, you know, like, I know this woman and I know what it meant. So it's hard to process. It's hard to help students figure out, but I think, you know, trying to focus on what can we all do together as a community to make each other safer.
Well, one of the first questions that was asked at a press conference about what happened to Molly was, what can women do to keep themselves safe? And I know that that's a question that a lot of us have been asking, but you feel like that was the wrong question to ask. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it was so interesting, too, because if you look at the answer that was given, which I think was a great one, it's Molly ran those streets. That's Molly's hometown. She knows what she was doing. Just as we have, you know, women and folks running around Iowa City, they know what they're doing. And we need to be creating communities that feel safe to do so. This is not an uncommon thing for women to, you know, want to go out and experience and navigate the world safely. But what we need to be doing is, what can we be doing to create safety in our communities, not arming only one one gender and saying, here's all this, all these resources, all of these, you know, pepper spray, here's mace, here's all these things, a taser for you. I mean, it's unrealistic for, you know, women to be told that that's the only way to stay safe. If we're not telling men and boys that when somebody rejects you or somebody says no, that's the end of the line. You don't keep pushing, but that's not the cultural script that we're giving men and boys. We're telling them, you know, if they say no, they're playing hard to get, and keep pressing on and be confident and keep saying, you know, why not? And oftentimes I think rejection gets turned not just inward, but outwards, and turns into outright violence against women. So we need to be asking, what can we do to better create cultural scripts for men and boys for rejection, for acceptance of change, and how can we, you know, better respect boundaries, better respect consent, and also creating spaces for men and boys to talk about that so that they can, you know, keep each other accountable, so we don't have constant cultural messages that say men are only supposed to be hunters and men are only supposed to be hunting women. And we can look out for each other and say, what can we do to create safety so women, boys, men, everyone can feel safe running, navigating the world, and just even, you know, helping each other out.
I want to dig down a little bit more on where you feel these messages are coming from for men in our culture. In the past year or so with the Me Too movement, I've often thought that we're expecting men and boys to suddenly understand that a behavior that has been normalized and okay for a long time, and even possibly romanticized in our culture, is not okay. So we haven't prepared men and boys for this world. Where are all of these messages coming from in your mind?
Yeah, and it's so many things. It's not just, I could easily point fingers at one thing or the other, but it's the compounded issues of so many things. It's cultural messages in our movies, in our TV, in our media, but also it's the social circles that we all run in. It's our fathers, it's our brothers, it's our best friends, it's our fraternity brothers telling us, do this. This is what's expected to be done, and this is how it's been done in order to get what you want, or chase the girl and, you know, get the girl. And I know I speak in gendered expectations and gendered terms right now, but we know that violence can happen to anyone across all gender spectrums. But it's important to know, as we've said before, that, you know, men wildly and across the board commit most gender-based violence. And so we want to make against women. So we want to make sure that we're, you know, looking at that and saying men have a cultural scripts from fathers, brothers, friends, that oftentimes across cultures mirrors the same thing. You know, be strong. You know, women are meant to be chaste. Don't take no for an answer. Don't respect that consent or those boundaries.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about what we can learn from Molly Tibbetts' murder and what steps to take next to make our community safer, our culture safer for men and women. With me, Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register, and Cody Howell, violence prevention specialist at the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about what conversations have been started in the wake of the murder of Molly Tibbetts of Brooklyn, Iowa. We're talking about women's safety and how our culture may need to change to help women and others feel safe in their communities. You are welcome to join our conversation with your thoughts, your reactions to Molly's death and to other stories. There have been many in recent news about women who have lost their lives at the hands of partners or men whose sexual advances were rejected. We'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register, Cody Howell, a violence prevention specialist at the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa. I want to bring another voice into the conversation here. Kelly Tieslink is a trail runner in Eastern Iowa. She's the founder of a local chapter of the running club called Trail Sisters and also executive director of Girls on the Run of Eastern Iowa. Kelly, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I can imagine, and I've heard from many of my friends who are runners, that hearing about what happened to Molly hit very close to home. What was your reaction?
The same. You know, I've heard and read stories about women being attacked while running and have always, you know, that really didn't hit me as hard maybe as it should have. But hearing about Molly was certainly a much different experience and reaction than I've had in the past. And I think because it was so close to home, it just made it a bit more real. And I felt a lot more connected because she was so close and because she was doing something that we both loved.
I think a lot of runners probably have thought, wow, that could have been me. Have you thought? Over the years, you spend a lot of time out running alone, many, many miles. You're an ultra marathoner, so many, many miles on your own. Have you thought about your safety over the years?
To be honest, it's not something that has crossed my mind a lot. I like to be aware of my surroundings and where I'm at, but because I run mostly in the trails, I'm not around a lot of people, and which could make people more scared because you're out there by yourself. But I have felt pretty safe on the trails in the past couple of years since I've been doing that. And I run in the pretty early mornings. And so I'm not seeing a lot of people out, which, again, could make it worse because, if something happened, I'm alone. But I want to run the way I want to run. And I will continue to do that in Molly's honor. And because we should be free to do that.
There's been a lot of advice shared in recent weeks about how to be safe, especially if you're a woman out running alone. There are technical devices that you can use. There are apps you can use that help people track where you are or that help you call for help very quickly. A lot of people recommend carrying pepper spray or mace or things like that. How do you react when I'm sure you've been given that advice?
Yeah, and Again, I think it comes down to you run the way you want to run. And if you feel safe and comfortable running with mace or running with an app so your loved ones know where you're at, or you have a system that makes you feel comfortable, do that. But if that's not your jam, and it's not for me, I don't run with really anything. I don't run with a phone. I don't run with anything to protect me. But that's the way I like to run. It makes me feel free and disconnected. And for some, that's not the way they want to run. And that's okay. I think it's you do what makes sense for you.
You've clearly made a very conscious decision not to think about this on a daily basis. Why?
Because running is a big part of my life, and I don't want fear to control the way I think about running. Running is an outlet for me. As you said, I spend a lot of time running, and especially running trails. It's a way that I connect with other people. It's a way I connect with nature. It's a way I connect with myself. And I don't want to let fear and one man's actions direct the way I think about running.
You participated in a run that was put together just the other night in memory of Molly. You ran with many women runners in Iowa City. Tell me about what that experience was like.
Yeah, so this was about a dozen women. I got a note from my friend Robin just saying, hey, there's going to be a run tonight at 9 p.m. at City High, which is a high school in Iowa City. I'll be there. I hope you can make it. And I didn't even think twice. I said, of course, yes, I'll be there, even though I'm normally in bed at that time. But this was important to me. I knew a few of the women, but a lot of us didn't know each other. There was about a dozen of us that showed up at 9 p.m. in the dark to run. And it was a way for us to grieve together. It was a way for us to connect with one another. It was a way for us to feel empowered by one another and support each other. And it was just a few miles, but out of all the thousands of miles I've run in my lifetime, those were probably a few of the most meaningful I've ever had.
What kinds of things did you talk about while you were running?
You know, we just enjoyed each other's company, and that's what was so great about it. We knew we were there in honor of Molly. We all wore hearts with her name on it as we ran through downtown Iowa City and across campus, and we just connected with one another, and since then have decided to make this a regular thing, to run in honor for Molly. And I actually, there was a Facebook group that was created, and I was just reading some of the descriptions, and I really enjoyed this, where they say that this group will help us find strength in other women and to make our neighborhoods and our town safer by announcing that we have the right to be here. And that really hits close to home for me.
Reka, in this conversation, talking about this pervasive culture that you say and many people say, you know, allows men to commit these acts of violence, even creates a situation where they feel compelled or like they have the right to commit these acts of violence. I mean, there are many people who are going to say not all men, and clearly not all men are part of this culture. There are many, many men who are not. When we talk about this culture that does not include all men, it includes a subsection, but you feel like there is an overarching part of our culture that allows for this, right?
Yeah, and I think it's partly cultural, it's partly economic. I mean, I think that there's an interesting common thread that runs through both the sort of anti-woman sentiment that's coming out in the wake of some of us pointing out the gendered aspect to this, as well as an anti-immigrant sentiment that come from the same place, that have a common root, and that is a feeling that men who are not getting ahead economically, men who are stuck in a place, who see the good jobs going to people of color or immigrants or women, a woman, for heaven's sake, being the nominee of a major party for president last time around, are looking for someone to blame. And so I think it goes a little bit deeper than just the feeling that, you know, that they have a right to, or they have this voracious sexual appetite, and so therefore, you know, they should feel entitled to any woman they want. And I actually really appreciated what Cody said earlier about the fact that the onus should not be entirely on what should women do to keep themselves safe. I think the larger question is, what should men be doing? How can we pull men of goodwill into this movement? Because, for heaven's sake, yes, not all men, yes, not most men, have these feelings of hatred of women or, you know, an extreme superiority of women. But I will tell you that some of the letters that I've received tell me that a lot of men do, and it makes them really angry to be called out on it. And they want to maintain their sense of entitlement and power. And we have to start by changing that. And I think it's men who have to lead the way.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Annette Lynch is here, director of the School of Applied Human Sciences at the University of Northern Iowa and co-founding director of the Center for Violence Prevention, also at UNI. Hello, Annette.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And you and Cody are doing similar work in various places. I know that your work has expanded beyond the University of Northern Iowa. You're also working in secondary schools in the state. Can you tell me a little bit about the approach that you're taking?
I started this work about 20 years ago when I was directing women's and gender studies at UNI, and I was facing the reality that while a vast majority of men in the United States are not violent and abusive, the majority of violence that was coming into my office against women was perpetrated by men. And so I wanted to take advantage of trying to find men that were a part of the vast majority who were not violent to partner with me. And I connected at that point with Jackson Katz, who is an international leader in terms of men's engagement and how to bring men into partnership with women on this issue. And I started working first on college campuses 20 years ago. And since then, we are in now 25 different schools throughout Iowa, secondary schools. And the real intent of our work is to create mentoring relationships between near peers. So a senior in high school working with a ninth grader that's coming into high school. Our studies have shown that young men listen a lot harder and actually change their behavior when a near peer works with them, much more so than if the director of women's studies comes in and gives a lecture. So I wanted to work with the Mentors in Violence Prevention Program, which was developed by Jackson Katz, to actually get young men working with other young men, older men working with other men, in order to move the conversation not just away from just how can women work on this issue, but how can we work on this issue together, and how can men become a part of the solution.
So obviously, a lot of this work started on college campuses. I mean, Cody, that's where you're working on a college campus as well. But tell me how it has moved into secondary schools. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense to work with boys and young men to change these ideas.
Well, Sioux City, Iowa, was a real leader, actually, across the country. Jackson always brought up the fact that the University of Northern Iowa was working on a college campus with his program, and Sioux City was really a leader in terms of implementation at the secondary level. And that work was really, at the point that it was happening, was really really a very, very big leadership step for that school district. And at the point that I got a flagship grant to work on three Regents universities, Jackson Katz, the founder of that program, said, you really need to connect with Alan Heister Camp and the Waite Foundation, who was helping to fund that work in Sioux City, and try to bring the college work and the secondary school work together. So what we did at that point was bring Alan here to campus to give a brown bag to talk about the work in Sioux City. We're able to get some funding so that we could start the Center for Violence Prevention in 2011 on campus, with a focus of not just college work but secondary school work. And it's been very impressive to me, the relationship between what's going on in the college campuses and what's going on in the high school work. We actually had in our, we have a wonderful fraternity here at UNI, the SIGUBS fraternity, that takes a very strong, positive role in working to end violence against women. And one of the members of SIGUB was from Waukee High School, and he went back to his high school and really advocated for the implementation of MVP within his high school because he felt like it should start earlier. And so there's a relationship between the work that happens at college level and the work that happens within high schools. But it's very influential when you get a college student that comes into the high school he graduated from and really talks to the young men at that high school and talks about these issues. And again, our statistics show, our evaluation shows, that it's much more successful to have peers talking to peers than it is to send Annette the expert or Alan the expert into the high school to do the work. I think that there was a discussion earlier about the fact that it's who we on this show, it's who you, the peer groups that exist and the social structures that exist that perpetrate and continue these norms. And what we want to do is interrupt those norms by working within those peer groups and not just be the expert from outside coming in and trying to direct that change.
Annette, can you give me an example? I'm sure you've observed a lot of these interactions in high schools. Can you give me an example of an interaction you've seen where you see that light bulb go off, where you see a young man think, oh, you know, this is a new idea for me?
I think that the strongest examples that I have are when a young man is empowered to work within his peer group in a way that he feels comfortable doing it, and not it's when you have peers work with peers, they're able to create intervention strategies that actually work within the peer group. And that's something I can't invent. It's something that maybe a senior can tell to a 10th grader that, you know, if someone is about ready to send a text message to a young woman in your high school, and you think it's a disrespectful text message. How do you interrupt that? And I heard an interchange in one of the trainings where they turned it into a bit of a joke where, you know, these are some of the different things that you could say to him that would interrupt that behavior. And it what the way that they approached it was using pop music lyrics, things that I wasn't familiar with, that would give that young man a strategy for talking to another young man and stopping him from sending that text message, but doing it in such a way that it was within the culture of really the music culture of that school. And so I don't even know the music everybody's listening to. So trying, you know, to send Annette Lentzian again to create those kind of interactions is not going to work, but it works within that peer group.
Is there a lot of thought given to making sure that we're not putting these boys on the defensive, not accusing them of being bad people just by the basis that they're male?
Yes. The other dimension that I really like about Jackson's program is it's a leadership development program. So when you're recruiting young men into this program in high school or in college, one of the major themes that is stressed is that this is a leadership opportunity within your peer group. These young men are proud of the work that they're doing as MVP mentors. You're being an upstander. You're being someone that's a leader within your school or a leader within your campus. I think success stories like we've had on our campus, where you have a fraternity that becomes very well known, not just locally, but receives honors for the work they're doing across the country. That's
influential. We're going to have to take a short break. With me this hour, violence prevention specialists Annette Lynch and Cody Howell, Rekha Basu of the Des Moines Register, and Kelly Tieslink, executive director of Girls on the Run of Eastern Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the wake of Molly Tibbetts' murder. Of course, Molly Tibbetts, a 20-year-old woman. Brooklyn, Iowa is her hometown. She was also a University of Iowa student. She went out for a run and never came home. In the wake of her murder, there have been many conversations about what it means about our culture, what it says about our culture, and what we can do so that women like Molly Tibbetts can come home to their families. With me this hour, Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register, Cody Howell, violence prevention specialist at the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa, Annette Lynch, who is the co-founding director for the Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Northern Iowa, Kelly Tieslink is here. She's a trail runner in Eastern Iowa, founder of a local chapter of the running club Trail Sisters, and executive director of Girls on the Run of Eastern Iowa. And we also have a caller on the line now. Katie Strong has been running across the country for the last 30 years, many, many miles. Hello, Katie.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for joining our conversation today. And tell us a little bit about your running. You've been running across the country. You've spent a lot of miles on the road.
Yes, I have. Actually, I've been running since June 17th, and I ran almost 3,000 miles all the way to Washington, D.C.,
Wow.
A lot of miles, raising money for military veterans that need service dogs.
Katie, how did you respond when you heard about what happened to Molly Tibbetts when she was out for a run?
Well, I was actually running in the same area as Molly at the same time that she went missing. And so it was very concerning on a lot of levels for me. Being, you know, in an isolated area with all the cornfields and so forth, I thought, you know, she's gone somewhere. If she was hurt, she might be in these cornfields. And I was literally running and looking for her down the rows of corn. And I was looking for a shoe or something she might have kicked off, you know, anything that would indicate where she was. I was in the same area. And I realized I'm from Southern California. I've not seen cornfields before, but there are miles and miles of them. And easy for somebody to take advantage of somebody that's running through there. So, yeah, so I was very concerned. And I actually had my support crew staying close by. Usually they are within 10 miles of me, but they were staying within 2 miles of me so that, you know, if anything were to happen, they could get there quickly.
Over the years that you've been running, you've had some really negative experiences. You've been attacked 4 different times?
I have. Actually, I've been running long distances since 1977, and I have been attacked 4 times, and I have actually strategies that I've always used, and I've been able to get away every time without any help, except for one time when I needed the help of the Orkin man who happened to be, you know, driving by in his truck and saw it was happening, and he helped out. But the other 3 times, my strategy is different. And I think, you know, girls that like to run should listen. I listen to music, but I don't use headphones. I just play my music and everyone can hear what I'm listening to. But I need the advantage of being able to hear if a car or a dog or something is coming up on me, and so that I can get a strategy ready in case they keep coming toward me. And so that is something that is really important in this day and age with the headphones and the Bluetooth and all that, to just don't use the headphones or just use one earbud so you can hear what's going on. And the other strategy is there's a couple. I've trained in martial arts, so there are a lot of different release moves and things you can use that are not that difficult. And I've actually spent time with my sister and nieces to show them these release moves, anything from somebody grabbing your hair and trying to pull you away, to grabbing you from behind, and wrapping you up. Or there's something you can do about everything that a person were to try. I would love to have YMCAs and 24-hour fitness clubs and things to make that available, as they do, you know, the Zumba classes have, you know, a defense class for runners, maybe 4 sessions, and that would be all you need. The other strategy that I use right now, it wasn't available to me 40 years ago when I started running, was mace, pepper spray. Everybody should have one, and the one that I use is about 2 inches by 1 inch. If it's in the palm of your hand and you can't even see that it's there. And so my strategy is to have that, have it, sits in the little pocket that running shorts have. As soon as I see somebody running up, or a dog or a person, I get that out of my pocket and I unlatch it and I have it ready to spray. I've had men runners actually run up, like this person did to Molly, run up and run next to me. Or just run by and wave, or just ignore me and just keep going, which is more normal. But if somebody comes up and runs next to me, I just tell them right away, I prefer to run alone. Could you please go on ahead and run without me? And the second, you know, they don't respond or they keep running next to me, that would be the time when I would spray them right in the face with that. And I'm going to err on the side of my safety, you know, because once I've told them they need to leave and they're not listening, then they're out of luck. And believe me, that pepper spray is really strong, and that will shut them down for about an hour.
Katie, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your responses with us today. Again, Katie Strong has been running since 1977 and ran across the country this summer. Cody, I'd love to hear your response a little bit. I mean, Katie's obviously had some really difficult situations she's been in, and she's chosen how she wants to stay safe. But when you're working with women on a college campus, let's talk about where women are at risk. I mean, what happened to Molly is terrible. It's statistically extremely unlikely. And I feel like we're not necessarily very good at risk assessment. Where are women most at risk? What scenarios?
Yeah, and I think that that's the important thing, right, is to realize that, you know, Molly Tibbett's case was uncommon. But, I mean, not enough so that like we don't look at the places like Ridgewater, Massachusetts, Mesa Park, Las Vegas, Keene, Texas, where women were running and were attacked by somebody they don't know. But realistically, it's uncommon for women to be put in the position where they're attacked by a stranger. Far more likely, you're going to be attacked or going to be assaulted by somebody that you know, mm-hmm. which when I used to work with survivors of sexual violence back when I was working in Montana, was that a lot of them felt like they couldn't fight back because that was somebody that they knew, somebody that they loved, somebody that they cared about, or at least that trust was being abused. So, you know, it's one of those things where while we look at this and we say, oh, maybe now I have to start carrying pepper spray. Maybe now I need to be carrying, you know, a keychain or whatever that has, you know, knives on it. It's unlikely. And we keep pushing this message onto women that, you know, the only way to be safe is to arm yourself. And, you know, the only way you're going to, you know, fend that off is that by doing all these things. But realistically, when that does happen and, you know, God forbid somebody does experience that kind of assault, oftentimes it's compounded with a lot of guilt and a lot of, you know, anger that they were saying, like, well, I took that class or I took my mace and pepper spray. But when that happened, I didn't have that in me. My fight or flight or freeze all came in together and I froze, or I did what I thought was going to keep me safe. And we remind survivors of sexual violence that you did what you did to stay alive. And that's the most important thing, is that when you do what you need to do to stay alive, you're doing what's right for yourself. But realistically, you're most likely going to be in a situation where somebody you know is attacking you, whether that be a classmate, a boyfriend, a partner, a dorm mate. You're most likely going to be attacked by somebody you know.
We have a number of emails on this topic. Here's one from an anonymous emailer. The discussion needs to move toward men who behave in a manner that threatens women. As a man, I don't want women to find it necessary to modify their lives. It's a blight on men that this behavior occurs, and we should be working hard to make it clear to our emerging young men that harassment of women is totally unacceptable. This is from Jane in Washington. She says, change will begin more authentically and effectively when leaders join grassroots action and stop making comments, such as the comment made by Governor Reynolds immediately after the news broke. Her quote was, "We're angry that a broken immigration system allowed a predator like this to live in our community, and we will do all we can to bring justice to Molly's killer." Jane goes on to say, "It deeply saddens and angers many of us when politicians take advantage of an inappropriate or emotional way, such as Molly's murder, for their own personal political gain." What specific action would your guests suggest those of us working at the grassroots level and feeling this sadness and anger take to be part of this important change in our country and world? And I'd love everyone to answer that question. Rekha, what's your answer?
You know, I was just thinking about a little paradox. Some of the letters that I got this week from men were interesting. Were not necessarily angry, but came from a perspective that women really need protecting because women are the weaker sex. So this one man wrote, women are the weaker sex. If they want protection, culture is not enough because nature is never far away. The old-fashioned way was for a woman to get a male protector. It still works if the woman chooses wisely. My wife married me for that very reason. And I was thinking about this in the context of Shannon Watts, who was murdered recently, allegedly, by her husband in Colorado, yeah, along with her 3 and 4-year-old babies and an unborn child. And I thought, boy, you know, that is just so wrongheaded. This letter writer was well-meaning, but you're not necessarily. And as Cody was saying, you know, you're more likely to be assaulted violently by someone you know than some stranger on the street. So it goes back to kind of reforming our entire view about male-female relationships and roles, and scrapping the roles, quite frankly. And also, you know, educating our daughters that they're just as strong and they don't have to be married, and they certainly don't have to marry someone who's not trustworthy and doesn't respect them equally in order to feel complete. I mean, I think that's part of it. And I think about running. I'm not a runner, but I think to me, as a metaphor, running is one of the most important ways, one of the most ultimate ways that a woman can exercise her freedom. Running is clearly an act of freedom. And that stopping a woman from running, intercepting that, is really a kind of way of saying, no, you're not free. It's a message. It's a statement. And those are the kinds of attitudes that we have to change.
So what action can Jane in Washington take, do you feel, to make a difference in her community?
I mean, I think that actually some of the emails that you read are very on point. This has to be a community-wide effort, and groups need to be meeting in their neighborhoods, men and women, and talking about what they can do. And, you know, it has to be multi-pronged. It has to start at the elementary school level, at the daycare level. It has to start with the messages that parents are teaching their sons and daughters, respectively, about their respective values and potentials. And then it has to, you know, we have to have a criminal justice system that reforms people and doesn't just process them, warehouse them, without actually addressing the root cause of the violence. Because it's not just violence. Violence is an extreme manifestation of sexism. But, you know, it has a different root, which is a sense of inequality of men and women.
Rekha Basu, thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Rekha Basu, columnist for the Des Moines Register. And I want everybody to get a chance to briefly answer that question. Kelly, I'll let you go next. When Jane asks, what can I do? I'm sure you've thought about this. What can you do?
So I think a lot of it has already been said, and I agree wholeheartedly. But I think that community aspect, right, being around people that you feel empowered by and feel connected to is hugely important and super supportive. I mean, it just gives you a safe space, right, to be able to connect and talk with others in your community. And of course, going back to it's not just about what can women do to stay safe, but what can we teach our men and boys to teach them that it's not okay. And, you know, when we're talking about violence, yes, that's on the one end of it, but the other end is things as small as catcalling, right? Like that is you're not getting hurt, but it makes women feel very, very uncomfortable in teaching men and boys that this is not okay. If you think it's funny, it's not. It just makes women feel uncomfortable. They're just out for a run. They're doing what they do to feel good about themselves. And when something like that happens, it just creates, you know, it can create a sense of fear. It creates a sense of somebody intruding in what you're doing. So starting those conversations young is hugely important.
Annette, your chance. What can people do to get involved to make a difference?
I think that within our MVP teaching strategies, really, we do devote a lot of attention to taking no for an answer when we're working with young men. I think dealing with the reaction to rejection is really an important focus. And I would say, like some of the other commentators have said, is moving this not just into the secondary schools, but moving it even lower into when you're dealing with daycare situations. You've got to get boys able to accept rejection without responding with violence. And so that really struck me with the Molly Tibbett story, and I was really glad that we had those scenarios within our training. But I think moving it down into the lower grades is desirable.
Annette Lynch, co-founding director of the Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Northern Iowa. And Cody, you have about 20 seconds, yeah. But what do you want to add?
Listen and validate those stories that women say when they tell you about their experiences with this kind of violence. And most importantly, if you're a guy out there who says that you would never do this, you're not one of those guys, you need to round up every other guy and have this conversation. You need to be the one who's pushing that change. So be that guy who's calling it out, who's changing that culture. It's on you.
Cody Howell, violence prevention specialist at the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa. Thank you so much. And Kelly Teesling, thank you. Trail runner in Eastern Iowa, executive director of Girls on the Run of Eastern Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.